The following recording is produced by the Village Zendo in New York City. For more information, please visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning, everyone. Oh, I hear my own voice. Wow. So I want to begin by thanking, I think our Shuso is the one who recommended our text for the for this period, right? I want to thank you for that. It you know, prompted me to do a much closer reading of Ryokan and both his life and his poems than before, and a rich treasure it is to do that. So, thank you. Ryokan was a weirdo, which, of course, we all agree is a good thing, because how else do you get to the Village Zendo other than, you know, being a little weird? Ryokan lived his own life with a freedom that I find challenging and admirable and not me. Start with poverty. He chose to not have things. He gave things away. People gave him a place to live, and, you know, he kind of adapted it. And when it was too big, he made it smaller so that it fit his convenience, his purpose, his comfortability. The poverty thing is what gets me. And in reflecting on that, you know, to choose poverty, I mean, you know, all spiritual traditions recommend it as a good thing. But, I mean, you know, for most spiritual followers, if you decide to give up the money-making, you know, business and to go into the spiritual life, guess where you go? You usually go to a monastery, whether it's Christian or Buddhist or whatever, where people take care of you. Well, that's not exactly poverty, it would seem to me. You know, it's a pretty comfy, cushy thing. And those of us here do our own adaptation to balancing out our life ambition and our spiritual ambition where they cross and crisscross and don't cross and don't meet. We sort of work that out in our idiosyncratic ways, all 80 of us or however many we are today. And Ryokan presents us with, what if we had voluntarily chosen to be poor? What if we had not found jobs and in fact refused them? There was a time in my life when I thought of this as an actual possibility, you know, and it's before I had to work for a living, you know. Adolescence is a good time for that. And, you know, so I lived by doing what was most important to me. And it worked to an important degree. It worked to such an important degree that it made me not be satisfied with being a construction worker. You may laugh at, you know, my being a construction worker, but I did do that for a while. And, you know, it was just to test out whether this education thing was really, you know, serious life or not. And compared with hauling, you know, those concrete blocks every day, it's quite fine, thank you very much. So, but Ryokan chose poverty, and he lived his life to the truest sense that he could explain and articulate and be conscious of. So that's the starting point. He was a person who lived alone most of his life. He lived in a rural area, had a little hut, and that changed from decade to decade or so. But he chose, basically, to live a life of solitude in order to truly focus on the inner work that is demanded of Zen practice. So, meanwhile, he wrote a lot of poems. And he wrote about his loneliness and how much he yearned for human contact. He says, "It is not that I avoid mixing with the world, but I do better playing alone." Meanwhile, he played with children a lot. They seemed to get it. He wasn't very well dressed. He evidently wore one tattered, simple black robe all the time. He wasn't very handsome. He left his hair uncombed and his face unshaven. He walked barefoot and his robe had tatters in it and was torn. He would go into people's kitchens and beg for food. Now that's a thought. When's the last time you begged for food? It brings up another related issue. I remember being truly hungry twice in my life, and it was all circumstantial. You know, one of those times was when I had no money. But the other time was simply a matter of, you know, having to wait. This was when I was a kid, you know, and a man came to the house and was trying to sell my parents pots and pans, and so he was going to cook this dinner in these special pots and pans, and meanwhile I was hungry. So I've not particularly suffered from hunger in my life. And the idea of voluntarily giving up what I have in order to simplify my life, I find tremendously appealing as an idea. Meanwhile, if I gave 1,000 books away, I would still have too many. You know, and the reason is, you know, I never thought of the family that I grew up in as poor. But I remember when I was in first grade, we lived out in the countryside. We hand pumped our water. You know, it was in a well and we had to hand pump it to bring it into the house. And we had to heat water to take a bath. And so there was, you know, not complete running water. And yet I didn't think about us being poor. That word just didn't come to my mind. I thought that was, you know, those other people, because I was having, you know, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich every afternoon that my mother made. I mean, what's better than that? And yet, it was in that same year when my father brought home a new car. And before I quite knew what model the Plymouth was, someone came and took it away. And not too long after that, we had another new car. This one was a Nash Rambler. And sometime after that, again, someone came and took it away. So there was something going on there, and I wasn't sure what it was. Meanwhile, my father's parents were in our little town relatively well-to-do because they had a pharmacy and, you know, had a regular business. My father was always changing jobs and switching between, you know, working the railroad and driving a truck and stuff like that. But his parents seemed to manage to have money. And my grandmother, my father's mother, was sort of the leader of all of that. She clearly aspired to the good life, and she wanted what it took to have it, and she sort of made it all happen. So I grew up with this, on the one hand, experience of sometimes not much, but more drivingly, this aspiration to be free of the vagaries of possession by having and maintaining rather than letting go. So I think it's very American to have a mind that is upwardly mobile in intent and to shape our lives around what it takes to live the way we think we want to live. And we pride ourselves in being able to do that. We don't stop to think very much about the fact that the way that we do that, how we do that, involves everyone else in our lives. Someone has to do more if somebody's going to do less. Somebody's going to have to do more if we're going to have more. So I was trained from an early age to enter this busy, 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 climb, 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 get ahead, get ahead, get ahead. And the problem with it is this. The problem was not with the brand new, you know, 1950 Ford. The problem was that what we had before that was not good enough. So it's that desire for more that gets us into trouble. It's that assessment, self-assessment, of not being good enough or not having enough or simply looking at what the Smiths and Joneses have and wanting what they have because they have it. I remember during this time that I'm talking about, we had no telephone. But our neighbors had telephones, And so if my parents wanted to call anyone, they would go next door and use our neighbor's telephone. So when we moved to a different place and managed to have a telephone, that was seen as an important convenience. Now we know it's a necessity. But it's the gap that's the problem. The gap between where we are and where we think we ought to be, or where we want to be. Not letting it really sink in that right now, right here, where we are, is enough. We are enough. And whatever our different life circumstances may be, we're probably going to manage, for the best part anyway. Which brings us back to Ryokan. He was very talented, not only as a poet, but as a calligrapher, as someone who knew how to write in ways that were consonant with the content of the words. And yet, sometimes he had no ink stick. Sometimes he didn't even have a brush. Usually he had no paper unless someone gave him the paper. It is said that he practiced his brushwork in thin air. Saves paper that way, as well as ink. And he was most happy doing calligraphy for children. And it's that that gives the book that we've been reading the title, Sky Above, Great Wind, because he wrote the poem to give to a child. So he writes, today, while begging, I got caught in a shower. For some time, I found shelter in an old shrine. Laugh, if you like, at the one jar and one bowl I own. Humble and cleansed, my life a broken house. Is this self-pity talking? Is it pride talking? Or is it himself being himself? He seems so at one with how he lives his life. His father wanted to make him a village handyman in training at 16. But upon hearing that, he abruptly ran away and went to a monastery. We've heard this kind of story before. As soon as someone who feels a spiritual calling reaches the age at which they may be co-opted by the system, intuitively, they run in the opposite direction. Some of us took a little longer to run in the other direction, but that's what we're all doing here, is we're trying to find our way that is not the prescribed way that we grew up as being normative. He begged for his food and water. He begged for lodging. He traveled all the islands of Japan. And everywhere that he went, after he did all of his official Zen training, everywhere he went, he was disappointed by the lack of sincere Zen spirit in practice. Have we heard of this before? Certainly that was Dogen's experience as well, right? Went all the way to China to try to find the truth. And in fact, there is where he received his enlightenment. So, with Ryokan, his personality was such that he could not stay in a monastery. He was too restless. You kind of wonder, you know, coming from some contemporary experiences about what it's like to be perpetually restless, irritable, and discontent. Some of you may know what I'm talking about. If that's what's going on for you, what do you do? Nothing in the world quite satisfies. But where do you go when there's no place to go? Well, you call Roshi. Can I come? And so we're here. He says, do not run after fame and gain in the realm of sound and form. Not running round is the continuous practice transmitted from person to person by Buddha ancestors. Mature hermits, beginning hermits, one person, half a person. I ask you to throw away the myriad matters and conditions and continuously practice the continuous practice of Buddha ancestors. And this from his poem on reading the words of Ehe Dogen. On a somber spring evening around midnight, snow sludge sprinkled the bamboo in the garden. I wanted so desperately to ease my loneliness. My hand reached behind me for the words of Ehe Dogen beneath the open window at my desk. I offered incense, lit a lamp, and quietly read. Body and mind dropped away is simply the upright truth. That's the way it is. That was my commentary. In 1,000 postures, 10,000 appearances, a dragon toys with the pearl. Toys with the pearl. Having fun yet? Beyond ordinary thinking, the precious tiger is captured. Thus, Dogen's writings reflect the Buddha's teaching. I remember the old days when I lived at East Itsud Monastery, and my late teacher lectured me on the true Dharma eye. It was then I had a breakthrough. The true Dharma eye is the subtitle or the meaning of the words Shobogenzo, the primary work of Dogen, as most of you know. I was granted permission to read it, and I studied it intimately. Until then, I had depended solely on my own limited understanding. Soon after, I left my teacher and became a wanderer. So what about that? Has that been your experience? Has the true Dharma eye been opened for you? Has that eye opened your eye? Have you found something precious worth giving your whole life to? I depended solely on my own limited understanding. Probably that's all of us at one point or another in our lives. The question is, how do we honor the part of us that says our limited understanding is not enough? How do we take that seriously? All of the externals of our lives may be in order, or they may not. for a lot of us, it takes a lot of chaos in order to get our attention. Soon after, he says, I left my teacher and became a wanderer. How are you doing with your wanderingness? Your wanderingness has brought you here. Are you getting what you need? Are you finding what does satisfy? How deep can you go today? Tonight may be something different, but what about today? Where is that inner hunger that brought you here in the first place? Is it getting fed yet? He asks, what is my relationship to Dogen? Everywhere I went, I devotedly practiced the true Dharma eye. How many years have passed since then? To practice the true Dharma eye is to allow ourselves to see what is in all its beauty or ugliness, in all of its chaos or even order. Allow us to see our own lives even for what they are, big, small, whatever, our very own lives. He says, forgetting myself, I returned home and now live in leisure. It's been apparent to me just recently that having an experience of peace within is the touchstone for my life. And I realized that mostly by coming to understand that not everybody has this. Not everyone has a place within that they can go to where they can simply be themselves and know that that's enough. A place where, you know, you may have plans, but you hold the plans lightly. Your worth doesn't depend on realizing your own plans. In fact, probably you forgot about what you used to worry about yourself. And now you're engaged in living life differently. And we don't even think about the fact that our lives are being driven by something that's within us and yet not something we can hold on to. It's within us and it motivates us, and yet we can't exactly crank it up or let it die. And yet it is ours to maintain. So we do this tricky business. It's called Sesshin. Or we do Zazen Kais. Or we do 20 minutes. Whatever piece of it we are ready for at this time in our lives. Ryokan says, I take this book and examine it quietly. Its tone is not in line with the teachings of others. No one asked whether it is a jade or a pebble. For 500 years, it's been covered with dust simply because no one has an eye for Dharma. What is he talking about? He's talking about Dogen's essay called Continuous Practice, which is evidently the only piece of Dogen that he had available to him. And there he's finding something that is coming alive. For whom was all Dogen's elegance expounded? Longing for ancient times and grieving for the present, my heart is exhausted. As I was sitting by the lamp one evening, my tears wouldn't stop. They soaked into the book of the ancient Buddha Ehe. In the morning, an old man living nearby came to my thatched hut. He asked me why the book was damp. I wanted to speak, but didn't, as I was embarrassed. Deeply distressed, I could not explain. I dropped my head for a while before finding my words. Last night's rain drenched my basket of books. Last night's rain drenched my basket of books. Rain, tears. Withdrawing from the practicing community, Ryokan walked alone through mountains and villages, ringing a bell staff and chanting a verse of a sutra at each house. He trusted everyone, and he would give loving kindness wherever he went. Regardless of whether people offered him food, ignored him, or harshly drove him away, he was determined to remain true to his path as a monk. This verse. In 1,000 years, how can I live up to the true path, even for a single day? In 1,000 years, how can I live up to the true path, even for a single day?